as I went out to sell model-based property management. It took me 2 years of trying and failing, to realize, you know what? They don't care about my doctorate. That's not what this is about. So in this last month or so, I want you to please pay attention to and rehearse this, our judgment, while this tension naturally exists. Yes, you should be now at a level 3 model with trace mix analysis. You should be having framed the problem, investigated options, really understood what might be possible. Now one must think, how would I make this happen in the real world? What would it mean to organize teams, organize stakeholders, arrange the system, both technical and social, in a way that our odds of getting something done go up? Please never, after you finish this program, never try to make your way by saying, but I went to MIT and... Stop making it harder, not easier, to actually cause impact in the real world. So we're going to focus that in the spring. You know, in the fall for project management, I was trying to not only share with you all the classics, these ways that people have done project management in engineering for a century. And you should know it cold now. Look, I was providing you a vocabulary. So in the spring, we're going to use that vocabulary, including our canonical project concepts. What were they? Waterfall, stage gate, flow, spiral, lean, agile, you know, these different ways that are accepted as canonical types. How can we actually design our project for the situation? Design for X. Let's get into it. The more detailed schedule for the 13th and 14th is published. We're going to do another recitation just on examples from last year and expectations for what happens on the 13th and 14th. But keep doing what you're doing. I thought the reviews last week were really helpful and useful. You're not done yet, so there's still more, especially in the next 4 weeks, that should hopefully inspire and motivate and shape what you deliver on May 13th and 14th. I released 16 and 17. They actually build on one another. OS 16 is about building a model or models. And 17 is about giving a model-based project approach. How can I exercise it? How do I make better decisions and better designs? Both Jim Lindus and Jim is online somewhere. And I are available, seriously, to spend time with you, to coach, talk. And I hope you have more than one kind of model. I hope that you try a couple of things, because every model is wrong. You can find what's useful in more than one type. I realize that your focus should be on the spring project, if not also work in other classes. I have readings. And I'll be introducing you to these readings. They're optional. You may want to keep these for yourself in the future. You want, if you have spare time, you can get them. I prefer if you have to trade between an hour doing your reading and spending more time with your project team, spend time in practice. Spend time, please, with your project team. But as always, from my lectures, there's if you pull the thread of the topic, you'll find your way to some other classes and other research that's behind the concepts that I'm introducing. Yes, thank you.
One quick question about this time, what is it going to be?
Yeah.
We are announced that in the first of May, and this show that will be the
So Friday or Saturday? It should be a Friday.
Friday.
It should be Friday. It is Friday. Yeah, I think it should say, both should say Friday on the official schedule.
Actually, at the time was updated, she said, but actually, I might be a different part of the
Yeah, what source of information are you looking at?
Announcement as well as
OS-17 from May 1st to May 3rd, due date, please. Thanks. Yeah, normally the PDF, the document that the instructor creates for the assignment is the official source of information. Patriots Day. Who's experienced who's on Massachusetts Patriots Day? Right? So you gotta just look, you know, you gotta get your tracksuit, get some Dunkin', go watch the marathon. If you're not really done this, it's a terrific holiday. So we don't have lecture next week, and the next lecture, there's only one lecture next week by Zoom. All right. So, you ready to, I'm gonna bring you back in, but we're gonna spend this first quick section just getting our brains back into project management, thinking about it, a reminder of projects as systems, socio-technical systems. It's not just the arrangement of tasks, it's arrangements of tasks related to a product system you're creating, but it's also the arrangement of the workers, the teams. And your choice as a leader is how to do that. Don't just blindly follow the standard work. That's for, you know, if you're working on something substantive and new, design the project. Think about what, maybe 80% is the same way you've always done it. That 10% of the way you might organize this project differently could make all the difference. So we're learning to think about projects as systems, and systems have elements, relationships, and dynamics. We stepped you through the fall, the elements of a project, the dynamics, and how they all connect. Well, the classic methods, including experience-based project management, which is the most popular, right? That's the most common way that projects are managed, is based on OJT and experience, on-the-job training. We're using our mental models. The Gantt chart is a model. All these things we touched on are models, which include some things that are different about reality. And that's okay if we're in a stable situation. This is all a reminder, by the way. I know we've talked about this, but I'm trying to get you back into this. It's okay. We should at some point always trust. At some level, there is sufficient know-how, stability, and readiness, often elemental, where the team bottom-up is going to be in the best position to have judgment and do good work. The issue in complex projects is if the entire system has not been stable, someone could perform well locally, but in a counterintuitive way actually cause havoc at the project system level. So, mental models are based on past experience, and when we rely on them without considering the impacts and systemic effects of the situation at hand, we get in trouble. And we also not only get in trouble, we might also miss opportunity. We might not be paying attention to ways that things could go better, in addition to avoiding risks. So that leads us to wanting to do a model-based project management approach. For complex projects, how can I accentuate my experience-based judgment? How can I make sure my mental model is keeping up and can handle more complexity than I would otherwise? It's not just the model and the analysis. The act of model building is an act of exposing assumptions. It's an act of engaging, involving others. It's a way of building teams so that we have more exploration and more consensus. And so I've shown you a bunch of different techniques. We're about to zoom in on parametric models, but you learn network models, CPM, PERT, right? You've learned DSM, and you've seen it applied to product systems. And we'll talk a little bit more about process systems. You've seen system dynamics applied to projects, and in January you experienced some agent-based modeling. These are all different models. They're all wrong, but have something different about them. Another reminder, when we looked at classic methods, the classic methods showed us basically these fixed tasks. And we took kind of the scope and duration as inputs, and we were trying to figure out how we resourced them as if resources are interchangeable and infinite, and costs would come out as well. And with designing rather than following classic methods, I'm encouraging you to understand that the triple constraint, scope, duration, and cost, all at risk, are emergent outputs, not inputs. And so we look at the situation, including the scope that is requested or needed, the resources that are available, how these things all connect, and we're designing by understanding, given the likely emergent cost schedule plan scope at risk, how does that relate to money targets and priorities, hopefully from the charter. So now I have a loop, and now I can design. And that's the biggest difference here. This is a box. Pay attention. This is a box. And on one dimension, I'm going to look at the ability to handle detail, detail complexity. And on the bottom, I'm looking at dynamic complexity. I could have something that is very little detail, but based on the way it's connected and related dynamically, can be quite complex in its emergence. So if I have low detail, low dynamic complexity, I can use my mental model. But as I get higher for dynamics and higher for detail, different kinds of techniques are more useful. All the techniques we've been showing you for treating projects as systems might have been invented to be a little bit better at handling dynamics, a little bit better at handling detail. So Gantt charts, WBS, I'm not sure where you would put them. Here's where I put them. Gantt charts kind of don't scale very well. You can make something with a lot of detail, but it's not, at some point beyond a few pages, it's no longer that useful to a human organization. The work breakdown structure allows us to now have a little bit more information in it because it has structure, decomposition. But suddenly spreadsheets jump way up. They're very detailed spreadsheets, and again, more dynamics. Mohammed.
Maybe this is jumping ahead, but can you give an example of low dynamic, high detail? Like, how is that possible?
Sure. Build materials. I mean, something that's just a lot of information, and all the relationships are linear and just additive. Right? So cost breakdowns. Costs are one things that just, they don't, costs tend not to add in a nonlinear way. They tend to add, or mass, or weight as well.
But that's not the whole project. So this is talking about the whole project as having too much dynamic complexity and or detail.
Well, I mean, think about it. If I have a giant Gantt chart with all kinds of detail in it, right? I can fill you a 60,000 line Gantt chart I saw for a real world project. The method handled it. It was not so useful, but the method handled it. Network models, matrix models, system dynamic, and you can say, do you agree with that? Why do you think? Let me go online. Anybody online? Jim, you're there too. Jim and I must have the same blue background. We're brighter than everyone else. But Jim, why would you put ST? I'm not sure if you agree where I place these. I'm not sure where you would. Jim, why would we say that ST is where it is, agent base is where it is on this figure?
I put them there because system dynamics models tend to have lots of feedback loops, which create dynamic complexity. And as a result, if you try and add a lot of detail complexity, you just can't understand it. Agent based, from what I've seen, tends to have fewer feedback loops, but is also capable of therefore handling more details.
Yeah, I think in the gym is what's the information or knowledge that's imbued in the model, and how elegantly is it captured, right? So I can force some of these other models to try to capture the feedback loops, but it gets awkward really fast, right? And tough. So that's the other way to think about it. Well.
This is a question. So, in my experience, I've had the benefit of working with hundreds of companies. Spreadsheets, WBS, and Gantt charts, they all use. Very few would use the other four options on this box. Is that because these are newer techniques, or is it because companies don't find them as useful? Why do you hear those?
Well, they are newer and they're not widespread. There's a big difference between In 1990 or even 2000, if I took a visual interactive model-based approach out to industry, people would just not even know how to look at it. That's changed quite a bit. Part of it's generational as well. So the comfort with computation, comfort with visual modeling has changed quite a bit. Also, I think, though, it's important to think about the purpose of the conversation. If the purpose of the contract of the conversation is a contract with a construction firm around a specific job, the tradition of contracting in Gantt charts is so well established and understood, and based on the nature of the interfaces, it's fine, it's sufficient. Right? Except for the 10% of the job that's somehow different, tricky, or complex. So we may have an understanding through our contracting, which is one model, but also the Gantt chart, that some of it is actually conditional, or there might be an option, or if it rains, or what have you. Good. All right, you guys are still asleep. Oh, yes, thank you. And Jameson, I'll get you next.
Yeah. Can you explain about the question of matrix model and network model? For me, actually, in terms of dynamic complexity, here is what I'm talking
about. So you think the matrix can handle more detail? But
yeah, network model can. For example, you can think about understanding the population.
I think mathematically they're identical. I think the question is, if we talk about what's the nature of the cell entry or the nature of the edge or link in the network model, if we're talking about them as having actually kind of very interesting nonlinear flows, then you're right. And I think we were more likely to do that in the way that network modeling is used. But I think, to be honest, they're pretty interchangeable. But sure, maybe I've seen, so the problem, I'm trying to think of which is the largest network model I've seen and the largest matrix model I've seen. They both get to a point where the matrix models tend to be a little bit more accessible to non-experts, I think. I don't know what you all think. But they both run out of steam after about this size of page. Yeah. Okay. Jameson.
I was just thinking about purpose, driving the usage of the model more than like what the best model would be. I just think, you know, if you're thinking about in the middle of a project, and trying to determine, you know, what the project is going to cost and when is it going to be done. I'm not sure that the cost to create and update one of the more complex models is necessary if a Gantt chart or a WBS or a spreadsheet could do it. And I'm wondering if that's what's driving the usage more than you know, what the perfect model would be.
Yeah, let's come back to the fundamentals here, which is, in fact, if it's a stable environment, and the work is standard, and there aren't dynamics, then you get no benefit from having the items on the right. I agree with that completely. But the nature of our engineered systems today is that they are, in fact, by nature, more connected, and therefore more complex and more surprising. So the problem with the methods on the left here is that the detail can fool one into thinking that one has precision and therefore insight. And that's not true at all. Right? A giant Gantt chart that makes everyone feel comfortable could actually be the worst thing for you. Now, your challenge as SDMers is to take all these new techniques and make them more practical, more intuitive, more natural. And we'll see what you do in your spring project. Okay? Thanks, Jameson. Hilo, did you have a comment? Yeah. But wait, I have to say, I told Matado that he has to ask a question. So I'm going to come to Matado first. Yes?
So I have a question about the purpose of the project-based model-based project management.
Yeah.
And, especially in the communication between client companies and my developers. So my company, JR, is on the client side in the most projects. So
yeah.
I think we need to keep communicating with developers, but sometimes we suffer from project delays or cost increase that we cannot predict or control. So appliance companies and
Communication across boundaries and insight about unexpected effects of propagating events. So if it's across a boundary, and what might be a small delay for me or a small consequence for me because we're now part of a bigger system could be a dramatic effect for another group. And indeed, these models are just prototypes of the project. And we're running the prototype to see what breaks. And we're connecting our prototypes to see what happens when we put them together. And I've seen that where, for example, in this was in high-end air conditioning, where there was suddenly a new, there was an acquisition, and there were two different companies that had very different ways of making decisions about new product entry. And based on the business agreement, there was an unexpected effect of the way that royalties versus shared revenues were going to be played out, which would lead to a dramatic effect for one of the parties, totally unanticipated as it came from outside their regular way of doing business. If we hadn't created, in this case, it was a joint business model rather than a project model, although we did it on a project, thinking about for a given product line in the next three releases, what would happen? If we hadn't rehearsed that, when would we have found out? Right? When we were in the middle of doing it. So these are just prototypes.
Okay.
You know,
so like you said, like if the project is very stable, like spreadsheet WBS function is very stable, so that happening in automotive industry right now. So I wonder that going to black side, so let's say if the project is let's say 1-0, would you say that one should be used by those kind of methods, or do you have any particular
if it's a one-off, one could use these techniques simply to build the project. You may or may not decide to control the project. So we'll talk a little bit about that on Wednesday, about how we use model-based approaches and design approaches, not only for conceptualizing and detailed planning of the project, resource allocation, but then also ongoing control. One of the issues with classic techniques is they're really good for a stable single scenario. And often it takes how long to build a classic project plan? Maybe months sometimes. Of getting everything together, stitching it together, building an integrated master plan. What happens when things change meaningfully? It's too expensive to replan, right? So what do people do? Kind of fake it. I mean, there's all these other things we do to get along, right? So the other promise of a model-based approach is that when we have a model, we can replan and redesign rapidly and regularly. Anyway, let's go on. Thanks. I hope this goes on. So. Please go to Canvas. There is a spreadsheet with macros, so I apologize if your corporate lords prevent you from installing it. But we're going to be in teams of three here in a moment, so hopefully at least one person will have this. This is a turn to your neighbor exercise. Let me explain the exercise, and then we'll do it. So this is a parametric model. And as I'll show you, the parametric model starts with a network model, so it's the same as CTM. But Tim Blackford, CPM, when I get you talking, I'm calling you. When CPM leaves out what interesting dynamic, what does CPM ignore that maybe we would want to pay attention to in a real world project?
Uncertainty
is one.
Resources.
Hmm? So those are dependencies, but they're kind of boring dependencies. Finish the start.
Resources.
So we're already thinking about, for any given method I choose, what's it good at, what's it not good at, how might I accentuate it or do something else. So this is a parametric model in a spreadsheet that starts with a network model, but includes resource load, cost, and divisibility of tasks in a spreadsheet. Okay? I'm going to show you three sheets, so please take a moment to download. I'll give you a minute, 30 seconds to download the PM crashing macro Excel workbook. Okay, there are three sheets. The first sheet is the project network, which is for reference only. It does update as you make changes, but don't make changes on this sheet. You recognize this representation as what in the corners of the each square from your favorite OS7. Earliest start, latest start, earliest finished, and therefore, because if I know that, I also know the slack, the total slack in each task. The second page is where you'll be working for input. And there is, on the left of the second page, there's these A start to end, including A to I tasks in that network. I can change my allocated headcount per tasks. I have a cost per person per week. No need to change that in this case. And a third thing, which is the divisibility. Divisibility. This comes from Brooks' Law. Brooks said something about divisibility. In some cases, if I add more resources, it doesn't affect iteration. Now, in this parametric model, it's the extreme. It says there's no effect. That's what it says. So if you add more resources, it should not have an effect either way, okay? Beyond the equivalent of one. The stuff in the middle here is just shown here. Stuff in the middle is just calculations. It calculates whether it's on the critical path. It shows you the total costs. It tells me the early starts and finishes for each of these. And on the right, you see the Gantt chart will adjust and change as you make those changes. So the only thing you should be doing is changing something here in the yellow. As a result, given that scenario, you'll see a total headcount, a total cost, and a total duration. That's for one scenario. I think you should be starting at, I think it's 30 or so. When you are ready, when you have finished a scenario, you click the snapshot button, and it adds the snapshot to the third page. Hit snapshot, and you'll see on the third page is added to a table, and the trace space is generated. Okay. So over the next 10 minutes, turn to your neighbors, so three or so people per team. I want you to improve this project. I'm giving you a standard initial scenario, number one, which is, this says 32209.93. I'm not sure what yours shows. Find it here. What does yours say? It's the same. Okay. So you can allocate up to 36 people, and you can move people from one task to another. Okay? As you make a change, design change, hit snapshot, it'll create a snapshot of that scenario, and try to explore to generate a trade space of cost duration alternatives. All right? 10 minutes. Yes, Lauren.
I understand what the law and the divisible and what you were explaining, but I didn't quite understand what true versus false meant, because there are two that are false and can be changed.
So false means it is not divisible, which means the work isn't divisible, so if I add more people, they can't do the work in parallel, concurrently, right? So if I'm doing a job in the field and I'm pouring concrete, it's got a set, I could have 20 people show up, it's not gonna set any faster. All right? All right, 10 minutes, go. And if you can switch the mic.
Hey, guys, yeah, up or down, either way. I guess I can put the mic. If you guys got it.
Thank you.
We did remove like 17 people, right?
Yeah.
Or 9 to 16 people. Cost it. I guess time saved.
Are we
compensated for the increase?
Are we assuming that people who aren't assigned a task are still getting paid? Or are we only paying?
I would assume no, because of how significantly the cost moved when we just reduced headcount.
True, right? But like that one we added people, but the cost didn't.
Yeah, I'm guessing the reduced time compensated for the additional
flip.
Yeah, they just kind of.
Yeah.
Cancel each other out.
Could we crank up, like, maybe on these two?
How many bodies do we have left?
Maybe six. Yeah,
we have one. What's that? Yeah, going for the win. Yeah, it's almost too good. It's like we should be trying some more random stuff probably. Yeah.
He's on the critical path.
For some reason, the cost staying the same now is just weird. Yeah, doesn't. Not sure it makes any sense anymore. But
oh, it's in the same every time.
Yeah,
can you check?
It's just some.
Notebook? I just want to see if the current path changed.
Oh, does that update?
I think you said update. Not yet.
I don't think
we've changed. Nothing's.
It is a weird cost.
want. I mean, is that, what's like an extreme thing to do? Like, what's just to like try art? Because we're like, how many people do we have? What if you just put like a
B? Like, yeah, a big B.
Yeah, try B. Like, just put like eight.
Yeah, like,
yeah.
That might make it.
Honestly, probably just try adding 9 to each letter, each step, and see like see which one. Yeah, bad. Okay, so it's bad. It's nice to know that there's bad.
Yeah, we're breaking it.
All right. Move. Get those people on me.
Move. That's like a...
That's a dead end. Oh, that's a false too, right? Yeah. Try,
What about this one?
Yeah, sure. H, right? Put 10 people there. Okay, cool.
Do you think
it's still going down?
What was like the first one we added people to? Like F or something?
E? We added 9.
What if you keep adding? Do you want to like find like the maximum effectiveness of adding people to E?
Sure. So
that's,
mm-hmm.
That's
a good idea.
People do it,
take like 5 off or like whatever. Yeah. And then move 5 to the E, yeah. Right, so this is like, oh yeah, look at how short, yeah.
Oh, this is played.
Didn't make any difference. Yeah, so that's interesting. I think that 5, it's also possible those 5, maybe just do 5 and 5, or, the 5 to 10 didn't make a difference for age, I guess. Also, we might be, well, yeah, maybe there's like, is there any other cost reductions we can make, I guess? Like 6, does 6 need?
Oh yeah, look at like the price.
Oh yeah.
This one, D?
D is pretty pricey.
Let's try that. Got up, went up a little bit. Okay, so that those might be valuable. It didn't reduce cost, huh? That's interesting.
I just wonder if we were right on like the sweet spot of finishing.
It might be like something coarse, like just not very like granular. And it's just like, maybe try us, see if you just reduce eyes head count. I'm just curious what will happen. Like make that like 2 or kind of 1, yeah. Okay, that got worse. So.
All right, folks, I hope we reminded you of most of the events. Just some observations. By the way, a question was asked us, can I go for these tasks that are indivisible? Clearly, any resource allocated isn't having an effect in this model. And you asked, can I assign 0 to it? Well, in modeling terms, you could. But you get to a point where you're like, that's probably not what the model intends. Like, that's not, doesn't make sense, right? And normally, if you're doing this in the real world, each one of these is a discussion about real-world feasibility, right? We don't have control over that contractor. We can't do that, right? So there's, mathematically, there's a very large number of options you may have. But the truth is, in dialogue across functions, you're going to be sitting there and saying, you know, is it actually possible to add another person to the need for this kind of work or not? And so the reality, the situational dependence actually makes a big difference. This is what I did. And this is a new scenario this year, so I haven't done this before. Notice that in this, what I call the design walk, this is kind of the journey we took. Because I want to remember all the changes I made and the assumptions I had when I was making them. I want to learn as I go, including things that didn't work as I expected. Because it's a system, it's a network, at any given point in that journey, in the design walk, some changes may be more effective or sensitive than others. And given the path that you take, certain things that would have worked early on don't work anymore. And I was able to very quickly kind of bring this down. In my case, it brought it down to 36 people headcount, 57K in 47 days. It's the same tasks, right? It's the same effort, the same scope of effort. This, in this case, a simplification of this model, it assumes a linear relationship between the number of people and duration. If you had a more sophisticated model, you might say, the first person at it is very effective, the fifth person at it is marginally effective at making this go shorter, and maybe there's a real world minimum. So you might think of kind of a much more sophisticated way. So how did you do? Let's go online first. Who online wants to claim that they have the best solution? Jonas.
We were able to hit RT or in duration, and with 36 headcount at a cost of $57,250.
So the same head. So one thing that happens is if you receive a project that's been kind of cobbled together, there's going to be inherent waste in that system, right? As you begin to tighten it, at some point you'll get diminishing returns. We call this, and we saw this in many real world project workshops. We call it the J. I don't know if you can shine the camera over here, but during exploration, why don't I have a giant chalk that the MIT instructor should have? Right? If I have cost in US dollars and I have a duration here, and we're starting up here, in a really wasteful project, some relatively small adjustments to your project without trading the scope might yield a pretty big benefit. So this vector is a change in your project design. Each dot is a new project plan, right? Okay. As you learn, some things are more sensitive to one than the other. But in some cases, you try something and it does this. And so you prune that, you don't follow that, you come back and you stop going down that path. Okay, this is how computer scientists think, right? Everything's a search in a maze. The whole point of the J curve is at some point, there's an inherent Pareto of any change you make at some point cannot be done without trading off another of your abilities, in this case, cost and duration. So you kind of know for the given project, given the scope that's represented, when you're finding that by seeing that J curve as it begins to appear. And that actually happens pretty quickly. Any other observations? Someone else online had their hand up. So, how is this different than critical path? Is this more useful? No? Do you do this already for your projects? Handling resources? Why not? This is so simple, it's just a spreadsheet. Yeah.
So, I don't know if I consider this different or not different from critical path, but the way we started was by addressing we looked at the critical path and allocated our resources according to that. So maybe I'm not answering your question, but to me, critical path was actually critical to doing this exercise.
So it's a model that starts with the critical path model and it extends it by adding some other natural phenomena, real world aspects to the model. What other real world aspects could you add or might you consider for your project if you're building a spreadsheet model? Tim?
Okay, from my experience, the resource availability, adding a person on a spreadsheet is much easier than getting a person actually working on a project.
Because people are just onerous, or?
No, you've got to hiring people, it's not easy, it's not trivial.
Oh, that's true.
You've got to fix all the resources, getting them on your project.
I use these kind of techniques both long before the project begins, so we're not yet talking about real people. We're talking about categories of folks. Just get a sense of what's even there. But then if I have a model and it's in the midstream of a project, then there's a different reality, right? There's hiring. For AT&T, I built a model with their team. They had a spreadsheet model, and we built an age-based model of the rollout from 1,000 to 7,000 call center agents globally. And these call center agents were in Manila, in Hyderabad, in Pikeville, Kentucky, no kidding, in Kansas, all different time zones. We built up the model, and we began to make the model more and more realistic. And it turned out that, not only determined the time zones, but one thing that really drove the outcomes was each location had a very unique pattern of onboarding. So how long to even hire? What's the probability that they would stay around or not? The training durations were different. Some places had to do dialogue coaching. And even the number of seats in the training facility, right? And whether or not there was transportation to allow for a second shift. All of those had a profound effect on all the possibilities we had. So you're right, Tim, absolutely. But the point is, ignoring these realities is actually worse than trying to add them and then confronting them. Because when we use critical path without resources, we're pretending that they're infinitely available. Well, I have someone else's other hand up here.
Yeah, I just want to, you can add that the fact that the headcounts, or you can have a constraint there because some people cannot work in every task. So there may be technical restrictions that you can have just put whatever number.
So you could build a model that actually had a resource pool, and when you were pulling from a resource pool, and you were actually identifying whether or not the resource was allocated to the same project at the same time. Yeah. Right. Online, David.
Yeah, I think not only resources over time, or resources by type, but over time, so that you're not allocating, you know, 20 people one week and 5 people the next, which might have an effect on costs. And then also the divisibility of work might not be just true and false, right? You might be able to divide a task amongst 3 people, but you cannot divide it amongst 10. So you might be able to set limits there to say, one guy could do it to 2 or 3, but once you go beyond that, you get diminishing returns.
Right, so we could add, even for any given design, if we now have specific resource allocation, you know, heuristics that suggest at what point is the allocation pattern just disruptive, right, and other things. So we can begin to think more and more about what realities should we include. Now, you're not, and you shouldn't try to make the perfect model. What you have to come back to is what insights are relevant to what's unique about your project, what's special about your project. Chao Lorenzo, you'll be the last one. And Jacqueline, I owe you.
Thank you. Coming back to Tim's point and people, another point I was talking about is like some people may perform better performing some tasks, and if they work with a specific subgroup, so maybe in some project you have some subgroups that are used to work on specific kind of tasks and can perform better. So yeah, my point here was just the social interaction between people and the expertise that some teams may already have, and is something that is not counted here.
I think that's right. Like, when I think about these sort of modeling sessions, the experts in the room are really part of the model. They have this sense. They may know that something is not practical or not political or for other reason doesn't make sense. The question is, how quickly can we generate new scenarios? Right? If we're able to, as quickly as you did today, actually explore multiple project plans quickly, then we're actually leveraging all that insight in the room far, far better. Okay, I apologize, I need to move on to the rest of the lecture, but thank you, and I hope that warmed you up a little bit. Could go back to my other screen, please. Thanks. So this started with these canonical product types, right? Flow, set-based, stage-gate, spiral, agile. And I think you got the point. We aren't blindly choosing one. We're thinking about the situation and the aspects of the project at hand, where parts of it may be more structured, parts of it may be less structured, some may be flat, some may be hierarchical. Even our resource pattern may change. So it depends. It really depends on the situation. So we're going to approach it the following way. How many of you have learned design for assembly at some point in your career, right? Design for X, right? We take a design and say, okay, if I look at this from the point of view of manufacturability or assembly, I would make adjustments to the design, or maybe I'm in the OBEA. What's the hero, I think you, what's the OBEA?
The
like always like a big room where we put every information on the wall, traditionally on the wall, so that we can make sure everyone's on the same page and going to the same direction. So always mainly owned by a chief engineer, which is product manager for the day.
Right, and so when we have a cross-functional team looking at the system, we often have some important figures of merit that we're trying to redesign for. So the way I've been in, we've actually taken and deconstructed a complete project, in this case, the product system, and looked at just how can we save cost, right? So these sorts of techniques. So we're gonna talk about, over the next couple of weeks, most of these: speed, efficiency, capability. How can I redesign this project to improve the capability of the firm? How can I redesign it to be faster? How do I think about evaluating this project plan with regards to stability, to quality, to distribution, to flexibility? And the only two that I'm not going to go into with the lecture are speed and efficiency. Why do you think? We've already done it. All of classic project management is about design for speed and efficiency. Schedule and cost. So we're going to skip through it. And so you may think about a set of questions. We're going to cover lecture by lecture one question that you should be considering when you're designing a complex project. Is the project designed for speed and efficiency? And today, what capabilities, human, equipment, materials, are tied critically to the strategy of the project? How is the selected project plan designed to ensure resource readiness and availability? A bunch of stuff you can go to Walmart and buy. But what can't you? That's what I say. There's a lot there. But generally, you know, it's we talked about critical path. That's, of all these things, one task is more critical, and we should pay attention to it differently than other things. Let's think about that with regard to resources and capability. That's today's topic. What capabilities are needed for this project? Is the project organization ready? And in turn, how will this project impact capability? And we'll wrap up with learning dynamics. What's the first one? We'll take a break. What capabilities are needed? Some of you may have in your company depending on, especially for capital programs, a regular step at the front end where you look to make sure, or you assess what capabilities are needed for the project. So who does that? Does anybody do that on a regular basis? No one in the room. Does your HR group do that? Does someone else do that, you think? Anybody online? Yes. Online? Not loud. Dizzy.
Yes, I think the IPT does that. They define the capability, then we work with the customer to put them the letter and get the requirement funded.
But Derek, is that an assessment of your own capabilities that are needed for the project?
Sort of.
So that's a funny thing, is there's a requirement about the requirement of the delivered output, or is it a requirement of who we need to be to deliver the output? Interesting. Dax, thanks, Derek.
Yes, so the Department of Energy NNSA tells us, hey, you need to have the capability to produce X amount of weapons components, and then we say, okay, we return back and say, that's what that means to us. This is a specific piece of equipment we have to manufacture to meet that capability.
So that's great, Dax. So inherently, there's a project strategy, which is something that would be chartered or a service level agreement in your case. And then based on that, we're asking the question, what capabilities are needed? Our service. Anthony, thanks, Dax.
I work for DR, so we have a product manager group who identifies the capabilities and the needs and what the farmer would need, maybe on a 3-year, 5-year roadmap, and plans that work. And we have to work very closely with them and to make sure that roadmap is done.
But is that, again, it sounds like you're talking about the customer's needs, not your own capabilities.
So they play into, so we are, they are expected to identify the customer needs first, and then our capability, we will be reviewing with breaking down, bringing to meet the customer needs eventually. And they have a bigger play, however functionality that's into that.
So I apologize for looking at the doubtfuls and a little bit doubtful, but it's, because it, we kind of confuse these two sometimes. Let me go in the room, anybody?
Okay.
Now they're waking up. Yes, in fact.
So, yeah, actually, I have some experience in, so we set up a new element in Jordan for the U.S. Army, and one of the things, you know, they tell us, you know, basically, we need you to be able to do these things in order to establish joint reception, staging, onward movement, and immigration. And so they say you can have up to 107 people. They can be distributed throughout different occupational specialties, however you want. And then conveniently, about 12 months, you get to do a what's called a table of distributions and allowances, like reassessment. So basically you say, in the last 12 months, we realized we didn't have any financial resources or like, you know, anybody capable of doing that. So we basically are able to take a look back and see where we need to rebalance in order to make our mission.
But that's backward looking based on recent projects, not forward looking based on expected new demands.
Yes, a little bit.
Okay. Okay. Yes, please.
Yeah, so in our organization, the people who are doing this capability analysis is a two-headed dragon, I would say. It's HR and finance, which inherently, I keep on questioning why is finance always there, but the working philosophy is that building capability ultimately leads to financial resources.
But is that, there's an interesting separation though in that case. If I'm the chief engineer or I'm the lead project person for some major new initiative, that function may exist somewhere else in the company. Let's say HR to know it, but I'm going to own this. I'm going to make sure I really understand. I'm going to go try to recruit the best person in the team over here because I understand for the project or scope at hand what is uniquely required. And I'm not going to promise that I can do this unless I build this great team. I mean, think of it, sports and performing arts are good analogies here, right? I could have a great playbook, right? But often when I'm thinking about a season, and even rehearsal, if you're in performing arts, you know, if I may know precisely what we're performing and what we're going to do, what the playbook is, but really what makes greatness is all the way I understand how to practice. I will make sure I build up the capabilities first at the unit level, but also as an integrated capability. That's a huge part of my job, is to focus on that, and we're going to get great performance. But let me dig in here. Let me go to Irene, and then, sorry, let's go to Irene, and...
So I just have an example of choosing the pool of resources than somebody else choosing the capabilities. So similar to what Tony said, we outline the customer requirements, and then my role is to just identify, for example, we need mobile development, backend development, whatever it may be, so just a general pool of resources. And then the tech lead for each one of those pools of resources is responsible to then identify one level down of the specific individuals, probably backwards looking based on their previous experiences and other.
I think, you know, one thing we might reflect on is what, again, these sorts of evaluations are inherent to any company that's just surviving and hiring people and firing people, right? There's someone doing it. Our job as systems thinkers and systems leaders is to bring the unexpected demands or needs for special capabilities into the conversation. We're the only ones in a position to know what is needed for this particular project, if it's unique. And that's how we use these techniques to do so. So just a reminder from, this was I think lecture 4, we talked about what is a resource. And there's all these techniques, including from Pinbach, all these techniques for estimating what resources we need for a project. Expert judgment, bottom-up estimation, analogy, parametric estimation. Someone has a giant spreadsheet based on typically past projects that we use. Does anyone here use analogy? Remember I showed you an example? The example I showed you, there's one on the left, that's from Eric, which shows estimation of ship production based on output density, and has a bunch of historic patterns and saying, where are we now? And I showed you in January, I showed you on the right, I showed you a major program that was brought to the executive council, and the cost and the duration were well under historic average. So there's somehow there's a technique to estimate and to somehow judge whether the estimation of the need for resources, in this case both duration and cost, and some assumptions about what they are actually reasonable. So what do you use? Rita?
I was really just stretching, but I work as a project manager, and one of the things I use often is expert judgment, because we've worked in the industry for a really long time, and then bottoms up estimating. That's how it's made.
Thank you. Mohammed?
We usually rely on historical data, like similar projects in the past, how much resources were allocated for these projects, and then that's the baseline.
Are the projects, these are telecom projects?
No, this is when I was doing physical security.
Okay. And are the projects similar? Is it a stable environment?
Yes, because you're kind of deploying the same physical security systems, but in different locations. So
it's not complex. There's no surprises.
Yeah, for the most part, yes, because we have a lot of good historical data.
Casey?
So I use analogy for many of our programmatic analysis of alternative methods. Due to some of the stuff we work on, it's kind of impossible to get new data. So you have to rely on historical data and make that analogical argument.
Thank you. And I'm waiting for someone from the military to talk about cost analysis. But Jameson.
Hey, I'm from the military. And I was going to talk about cost. We do 1 through 4. We do expert judgment, bottom up, and parametric in analogy, especially when we do the annual cost estimates on our ACAT 1 or big dollar programs that we do every year.
So, Jameson, you'll be happy to learn that we're going to talk about earned value soon. And the truth is, a lot of the classic cost counting techniques came out of the Navy. And eventually became morphed into what later became earned value. And we'll talk in some detail about those as control techniques. And the question is, are they estimation techniques, or are they control techniques, or are they both? What purpose do they serve? And there's a lot of opinions. Let me go to Bernardo.
Just a quick question. When you're saying analogy there, like when we were discussing kind of like t-shirt size, like for software, for example, is that analogy? Is that what we call analogy?
No, because you're not actually comparing it to the t-shirt production process. So it analogy means I'm comparing this project to other projects that may be analogous. And I'm saying this is most like this kind of project, and therefore I'm going to use estimates or historical averages. That's analogy. I'm comparing projects of different kinds of types. Whereas bottom-up estimating is top-up. T-shirt sizing is expert judgment, but maybe without expert. T-shirt sizing, I mean, it depends. But t-shirt sizing is just, I'm not sure what it is. I mean, have you ever done the poker thing, Bernardo? There's another technique in software where people play it like a, you're forced to only allocate certain things. Do you seem to know that approach? So there's all these little tricks. But some of these tricks are cute, but they're really just a semi-structured way to get some expert judgment to make the analysis. Aladdin.
In software, the type of technique that we use, one is vetting. If they have multiple engineers vet, and we basically pick the shortest one. And the other one is the spike. I'm not sure exactly what that stands for, but the idea is that to just have a team basically start on the task, time box, say for about a week or two, and then based on their learning, they can come back with like more accurate estimates.
So the time box. So you know, what's funny is no one has complained yet, but are we talking about scope estimation or resource estimation? I'm confused. We haven't really kind of sorted that out here. We've gone back to a topic we discussed previously in the fall. And we've got to sort that out a bit. Are we talking about the nature of the demand, or are we talking about the availability of supply? So I showed you a bunch of other techniques as well. A lot of them are weighted score, just kind of weighted scorecard techniques, including the product PDRI, which is used in the construction industry, which is, this it turns out is what? This is a readiness index. That means that it is a measure of whether we are ready to proceed to the next stage of capital investment. So it is a score that talks about our, the completeness of information, but also the readiness and availability of resources needed in some weighted combination. I mentioned Song, who said, this used to be based on in the Kokomo, Kokomo 2 in software, was based originally on first lines of code, then went from lines of code to function points. And also then in engineering, we've gone from drawings and parts. So everything was drawings, and you could actually then look historically at how many drawings, assembly drawings, part level drawings, historically you had. And now I can say, oh, I've got so many new parts, and that's going to be so many drawings. That became a stable way of doing it, but we moved away from paper-based drawings. And so we now have a new, need a new way to understand what the required energy, engineering effort may be, given that we're designing items rather than building CAD models rather than drawing drawings. And this one, which is, who has something like this? I think this is based on PRTM, the company that consulting firm, they put this out. This is a, this says that for the project at hand, not what's the scope, but what's new. And given what's new, what do we need in terms of resources? So what's different here? And this is a measure of complexity by subsystem and how the complexities add up. And then this is another example, different example from the fall of IT project sizing. So these are all the techniques to say, okay, what's the nature of the project scope? What's different about it? And what does that imply about what kind of resources may be critical? But how do we know if then we are ready? Let's take a 5-minute break. We'll come back. We'll talk about it then.
Looking at the looking at the sun, eclipse. Right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's dangerous.
So only look at it with one eye.
It's dangerous.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
And you know, you don't know how it'll affect people's minds either. People go a little crazy during eclipses. Chloe, I forgot to check in last week.
Oh, so you were in Frederick?
Yeah, I was. So
I guess. I'll mark you.
Okay.
Hey, Kresky, meaning you just come in front of Kresky?
Probably you will need to chase me.
I will be running. Yeah. I'm just worried. I don't want to be outside during the question.
You want to be outside?
Like, you know, right?
You
can't look at the sun when it's not
like the galleries.
Are you the only one
to
be there?
Like, I don't want to, like, keep looking around.
I'm planning to be there too.
Right?
So, yeah.
Yeah, I'm just
scared. You need to chase me. You need to, you know, tackle me to get one of the glasses.
Do you want to share with nice people? At least Laura, you want to share. You don't share glasses, but you also want to share.
Start now.
What?
No.
No. Why? Why are you?
This was your
favorite boy. Yeah. It's the perfect day to.
Which one is this?
You want me to make another
friend of the No. Why? She's a donkey.
Let me go back and make sure that my wife is
on goal is to be able to be. Where we need to focus on getting better.
The OPM3, that's the Project Management Institute's PMI model, basically asks 500 questions to come up with a score on certain project, program, or portfolio capabilities. I think that's too much. Let me show you a simpler version and an example. So this is, you can go as 1 to 5, this is 0 to 3, which this existed before, I think, the OPM. I also use level 1 to 9, they have different meanings, but broadly you say for some subset of skills, I'm gonna have a measure that goes from a low level, which is somehow ad hoc and troubled, to a highest capability measure. I'm going to describe each of those processes. Think about a process. Hiring is a process. Noise and vibration analysis is a capability. Manufacturing readiness is a capability. So all these certain capabilities, and you know what it's like. You walk into the shop, and you talk to folks, and you kind of get a sense of, is this a stable environment? Is it a safe environment? Do they know what they're doing? It's like if you walk into a factory, you can tell if it's chaotic or they've got their act together. This is a systematic, structured way to actually get a sample. And the assessment or the questions to determine whether you're level 0 or level 3 are specific to each separate kind of function. This is an example going back from 0 to 3 for project management. Let me show this to you. So here I have a major area in the life cycle of an engineering project, from defining project organizations. Within each of these major categories, all the way through the life cycle, I have all your favorite, the charter, segmentation, product specification. So these are all very specific capabilities, in fact, they're risk, that we would expect a high-performing organization to master. And for me, when I do this, so for scope and charter alone, see an example. I'm not sure it's this example, but 12 global engineering centers for a corporation, and at each center doing typically 15 to 20 interviews. And the interviews are up to 90 minutes. And I might spend 10 minutes alone just on project scope and chart and talking to someone about, from their experience in the company, do they exist, who's involved, so you kind of talk through that scale. And most of these assessments are actually self-assessments. They're saying, okay, now here's where we are on this scale. And you do it across the organization. What I'm showing you here is for a real world project is the level of function of capability partnering as assessed on average across this organization. Of course, averages are flawed, right? So you really want to get more inside information than just the average. Or already, what can you say about this company? Where are they strong? Where's the need? What stands out? Cody.
I have a quick question about this, and just your background, like Yarmy is a very similar system with this for assessing units and the capabilities for the mission set.
Yeah.
How often?
Wait, can you say that again slowly? It's like a different language.
Yeah. So the background is Yarmy uses what's called a combined arms training strategy, and it basically assigns a set of missions for each unit based on like their type. Like a live unit might be considered an aerosol unit. And it has
five. So this missions. Is a functional capability that they should have, a mission they should be able to fulfill.
Yes. Yeah, so then basically you create a sheet like this for each of those missions, and you assess their capability, and it changes, but generally it's untrained, trained, or proficient, and that's flip flops.
Right.
How often is this assessed?
Well, so my experience for engineering project management, for engineering projects, is it takes an organization the life cycle of more than one project to get better. So if you do it more than every 2 years, you're probably not going to get new information. So most of the transformations I've done have taken 2 to 3 years. So you do an assessment at the beginning, you might do a sample in the middle, but you're really pushing hard over that 3 years to move everyone forward, and then you do an assessment at the end as well. Of course, best practice is to have the assessment done in a way that's either third party or impartial, so you're getting good data. Yes?
So in Chevron, we use like something similar for like our contractors' capabilities. So like we do a year, we do 2 reviews per year where we look at a whole list of what they're actually capable of doing, right? And we assess that, and then if they have any new, you know, capabilities, new trainings or stuff like that that they require, then
Are you measuring what they can deliver? Or are you also measuring how good they are at it?
How good they are and what they're actually capable of.
And then, given that information, what do you do with it?
So what we do is that we enter in the system, and then they can only perform the work that they're actually
do you invest in them?
Sorry?
Do you invest in them? If someone is not doing well, like look here.
Oh yeah, yeah. So we
clearly this stands out here.
Yeah. So
right.
So then we create a mitigation plan.
Thank you. All right. So things stood out. So project budget management, they were really good at accounting, but not a lot else. And even that was just basically decent. And risk really, really stood out for this particular company. Yes, Tom.
So in order to make the project smoothly, I think some kind of asset is important, such as automated kind of stuff or digital kind of technology or so on. So in that sense, this kind of asset, which one could be attributed to such a kind of asset?
I think my experience is that one can tie some of these measures to output or performance measures, but that would be a grounding scale. For example, if someone will claim that they are really good at quality, but then the data shows that they have horrible warranty issues, right? Then there's a huge gap between the self-reported self-assessment of what they're good at and what the performance is. This technique generally is a self-assessment. People are reporting where they fall on the scale, and you look for the gaps between the real-world performance. So I think one needs both. Has to have some measures of, they're not automated, but you have to get scorecards that are tied to performance metrics. But at the same time, one also needs to assess bottom-up in terms of self-assessment. Ben?
I think you kind of answered it at the end of your statement, but I was going to ask, is there a best practice for the program itself to do this assessment, or is it better to get another program to maybe have their PM analyze or just get a consultant like you did for this? Because I feel like self-assessment is usually very flawed, and there's a bias there.
This is the tricky part. All transformation starts with self-recognition. So if it's a third party who's an outsider, and they come in and they say, you're bad at this, people are going to often push back. So the important thing when I say self-assessment, the point is we want those who must transform to own this assessment and to feel that they're part of the transformation. What we're bringing to the table, though, is a transparent means of evaluation that can be reproduced, and that is collective, not individual. We get into this much, much more, but let me move ahead so we save some time for Jim. This is a similar technique applied in a different place. And in this case, this is the data. The score here is up to 5, I think. Maybe at the 3. 0 to 3, I think, in this case. But notice that we showed in the middle, this is inside engineering. Means this is the people who did the self-assessment, the population. This is what the scores were for people inside engineering. And we also interviewed people upstream from engineering and downstream from engineering and people working in parallel. The second set, we looked at the data, we sliced the data from the point of view of how much experience they had in the organization. This was fascinating. What does it tell you? This shows that people in their first 5 years, people in the middle of their career, 6 to 10 years, and people longer, had radically different views of the front end of the engineering process. Why would that be? Yeah, Sonny.
I can relate to this. When you first get into an organization, and everything feels good, then slowly you start to see all the negative and be jaded. But then after a while, you start to understand why decisions are made.
Well, in this case, if the particular dimension here was around, let's say, decision making, that could be exactly the process. But notice that each of these things is a very specific set of assets, capabilities, things that are done, and that they're measured in a way. I think in the middle of the organization, they may have more awareness of the day-to-day complexity that we all face. The other thing we've done for these things is do it by location, and the data is remarkable. The point is, this all ends up being a rich way to assess what our current capability is. Here's another, just a different assessment, which goes from unpredictable all the way up to beyond implemented. So most of these measures go to just defining a process and having it accounted for. What we understand now from research is that just that gives you, that hedges your bottom end. It prevents you from having bad performance. But if we look at high performing teams, they actually exhibit a lot of flexibility. And so if you only adhere to standard process and everyone's just doing their job, that doesn't lead to the best performance. It leads to good performance. So what we see in high performance teams is something beyond that, and fully performing. So we developed a new way of assessing. And so in the end, this is a different real world example. It's hard to see here on the right, I apologize, but this is for engineering project management. Each of the columns on the right is a different measure. And this is showing two dimensions. For example, E1 is project management reviews, P5 is V&V planning, and so forth. So the dimensions here show the priority to improve on the y-axis, and the capability score 1 to 9 on the x-axis. What does it mean where utopia is here? Priority to improve. Not only do we ask people to self-assess, we ask people in the organization to tell us, if you were in charge, bro, what would you want to change first? Why does that matter? Your job is to lead transformation, right? These are low-hanging fruit, where everyone agrees there should be something done, and there's an assessment of there's the greatest need, then you want to begin targeting those right away. So your design of an engineering project transformation begins up above, and so we started to identify very specific capabilities, team and resource planning, platform and architecture selection, feasibility forecasting, as three topic areas that we can invest in immediately. One last thing, then we'll turn to Jim. Now we ask, how will this project impact capability? This is not done as often as it should be. I designed a project, we're going to operate it in a certain way, we made all these trade-offs and decisions about how we're going to do it. Is the way we're doing this going to kill the company? Are we going to exhaust people? Are they going to come out of this project better and more capable? Are our assets going to be depleted, or are we going to be in a better position or not? And trust me, if you go back to an executive with a project plan that has a little bit more training or a little bit new, and it leaves the company in a stronger position afterwards, they may be willing to pay for that. Senge referred to teams as the key learning unit in organizations. That's where learning happens. And so how you design your project determines whether or not teams come out more capable on the other end. We heard from Nonaka and Takeuchi before. Does anyone remember that name? Nonaka. Thank you so much. Why don't we talk about remedial diagnosis, Nonaka? Why don't we hear that? The new product development game. I shared with you a paper from 1986 that was a precursor to Agile. It really characterized what cross-functional concurrent engineering could be. Nonaka is actually more famous for this model of learning. He calls it the knowledge-creating cycle, or the Seki model. And Seki stands for each of these four words. There is socialization, externalization, accommodation, internalization. This is a model for how knowledge is generated and sustained inside a firm. There are certain things we do to take tacit knowledge, like judgment and experience, and make it explicit. There's certain ways that we take that and we combine it with others to create new, which in turn creates internal. We need all of these to be active and in place for there to be an effective knowledge creating cycle in the firm. If you have a process, or maybe you a performance process, that is simply about having everyone document everything, and it goes off into some bin somewhere, but that never is combined and socialized, if there's no way that that actually finds its way back into tacit knowledge, it's not going to be useful. At the end of the day, the tacit knowledge is what actually leads to better performance. Did I tell you the story of designing? I think I did. That one of my first jobs was to create a knowledge-based design tool for headlamps. Did I show you the story? Nissan Obama. So headlamps. And there was this guru, this old dude, he probably was 40, but to me at the time he was old, who was the guru for headlamp design. And headlamps are really interesting. There's optics and there's safety and there's all kinds of stuff going on in headlamps. And so we built a tool. And he showed me a rule book like this. Very, very incredibly beautifully documented of all the things one has to consider when designing it. And I said to him, that's why we're so good at this, because we have this document. And he laughed at me and said, no, Brian, the document's good because we're good. It goes the other way around, right? We have a good document because we know what we're doing. We have a regular process of doing this. So paying attention to how, whether it's lessons learned or documentation, is it all serving to improve the capability of your teams over time? Or is it just an accounting exercise that's distracting, that's taking away from your teams? Now, there's a great paper by Amy Edmondson, which I encourage you to take a look at, which is about learning, especially in product development teams. And they identify five different attributes that hinder teams becoming better at what they should be capable of. As complexity increases, the more cross-functionality there is, if there's temporary membership rather than longer-term membership, if the team boundaries are fluid and not clearly stated, and if there's embeddedness in other organization structures, this all hinders. And so they have a set of prescriptions for benefiting teams, especially in new product development projects, that actually they show, the research shows, actually improves performance by adding project management skills, for giving them tools to be able to manage the cross-functionality, giving them a broader perspective, actually investing in your ability to do teamwork, expanding their social network, and especially the boundary expanding skills. So you may think about, for your project teams, where are they weak? And put in your schedule, put in your budget, investment in targeted training at key interfaces for key teams to help evolve them and mature them, not only because that may be where your biggest risk is in the topology of the whole project, but also because you're going to leave the project teams better off at the end. And she goes on to say, and her co-author, that this is very much about how the project leader creates an environment that is psychologically safe. I go back to that second model, Neil Naka, right? If you weren't, people like Montessori, you didn't go to Montessori school. You didn't, you should, Michael, you still have a chance, you can go to Montessori school, any age. But you have to play in the sandbox to make this stuff stick, right? There has to be some active change. And so in the project itself, we need to create an environment in which people are, first of all, emulating the leader who's willing to admit when they're wrong and willing to make changes, but also create an environment where people feel safe and available. And this is, this is not easy to say in a classroom. In the throes of being in the field when things are tough and mistakes are being made, it's especially harder, even harder, to create that environment. But in fact, that's what research shows us leads to better outcomes. So, Jim, I'm going to skip this and come back to it on Wednesday. Let me turn to, unless you'd rather do yours on Wednesday, your choice. Jim, are you muted?
All right, I was muted. Why don't I do mine now quickly?
Sure.
Can I share my screen, Ryan? Or
if you'd like, yeah. I assume so. I don't know if what Ryan thinks.
Yeah, okay.
But I'm showing your slides for the moment anyway, if you'd like me to.
Right. I think I got it.
Thank you.
Good. Good morning. Good afternoon, I guess, everyone. I'm going to wrap this up quickly by giving you an introduction and an overview of how of models of learning dynamics and capability development, some of the history, why we're interested, what the basic structure is, and then what are some of the complexities and considerations in product design. And more importantly, perhaps, where to go from here if you're really interested in that. So let's start. says. Fair. Why do we care? We're interested in how individual and team effectiveness evolves over time on a project, and why does it matter? First, we're concerned with where we start. Are we starting low or high? And how, over the course of the project, does our effectiveness evolve? Does it go up smoothly and quickly? Is it more of an S-curve? Do we have some bumps along the way? And this is important because where you start and how it evolves has a significant impact on cost and schedule over this project and over multiple projects. And it's important, therefore, we need this understanding in order to produce a more accurate estimate and to better forecast EAC as the project evolves. But we also need it in order to make design choices. What capabilities are we requiring to meet the scope and timeline of our current project design? Where is our staff? And how big a gap is that? How quickly is it going to close? And is that what we want? If there's a big gap, then maybe we're going to need more budget and schedule in order to get it done. If there's a big gap, maybe if we can't stomach that budget and schedule, maybe we ought to cut back on the capabilities needed. So we need to understand this process in order to make these design choices. And that should be, therefore, learning development should be an important part of these models. Now a little bit of history. The earliest model of learning curves was back in, you can see the date in this paper, was 1936. And it had a graph here that showed that unit costs, average assembly hours per aircraft, decline with cumulative production. And the model that corresponds to that is shown here. Now, that was carried on to a very successful consulting career by a gentleman named Bruce Henderson, who founded the Boston Consulting, and that group, and he generated a lot of data that essentially verified the learning curve from aircraft that as experience doubled, costs declined 20-30% with each doubling. And he combined that with things like his growth share matrix and other consulting matrices to generate business strategies and a very successful consulting company. Brian talked a little bit about that back in PM1. On projects, we tend to flip the learning curve. We tend to look at how productivity and effectiveness evolve, starting relatively low and then improving over cumulative experience. And this kind of curve applies not only to individuals, but teams as collections of individuals. And so if you look at it in that perspective, you can say that there are multiple different types of capability and learning that we might be interested in on a project. How the product or the technology works and how that improves over the course of the project. In fact, that may be the purpose of the project, is to develop that capability and generate that learning curve. How to use new tools or processes is going to have a learning curve. How to work together as a team, how to work with a client, and so on down to individual knowledge and skill development. Different learning dynamics will impact project performance, and therefore it may need to be represented in any models of project dynamics. now let's take a look at the basic structure that underlies, I think, almost all learning models in any type of model. I'm going to show you the system dynamics diagramming convention, but the same processes can be represented in system dynamics and agent-based models. I suppose you could even put them in spreadsheets. And you saw this in EM 412 in the system dynamics workshop, where basically you start by bringing new people or inexperienced people in. Over time, they gain experience and become experienced people. And combination of inexperience and experience generates your total staff. We assume that inexperienced people are less experienced than experienced, and therefore the more of them you have, the lower your productivity and the more fraction correct they're gonna be, so that slows your progress. And I showed you these equations back in January, so we won't look at them again. But the implicit assumption here is that time drives learning, or that time is being spent on activities that drive learning. We'll simplify that in a minute. And if you simulate this, what you see is that if we start with all our inexperienced people, let's say 10 people, then over time, the number of inexperienced people goes down, experience goes up, and the effect evolves something like this. And this matches learning curves research quite well, that it has this exponential approach. And the time constant is important. Come back to that in a minute. But first, if you have turnover out of this group of people, then what's going to happen is, and you replace them with inexperienced people, then your experienced staff go down, experience go up, and you get a different dynamic. So one important aspect of this is the time to gain experience. And the longer that time, the flatter this curve becomes, and the longer it takes to become fully effective. Now, we can make these models more realistic, and that's going to be important. For example, if instead of continuous learning, suppose you have downtime between projects or the use of a tool, then your learning flattens. If during this time that you're not using it, you actually forget, then you can see learning dropping, coming back up. And you never really get to the full capabilities that you would have had if you continuously learned. And so models can be useful in trying to understand these dynamics. We can also use these models for designing the project. How can we design a project to improve performance and accelerate learning? For example, what would happen if we used more experienced staff? On the green or good side, suppose we bypassed here and put everybody into experienced. That increases productivity. The downside is it shifts the staff development burden to other projects. What about more formal training? Suppose we put a training delay in here. Eventually, that's going to make people gain experience faster. But it also delays the time when people begin working on the project. So there's a short-term hit to progress and hopefully a long-run benefit. And we can continue looking at these trade-offs for other project design decisions. Should we increase supervision and coaching? It has a benefit and a cost. Should we spend more time, as Brian was just mentioning, formalizing explicit knowledge, formalizing our tacit knowledge into explicit knowledge? In order to do that, that requires taking experienced people, usually, taking them away from project work so that they can translate tacit knowledge into explicit knowledge. And then once you have that, you're going to have training that delays the introduction of people to the project. So there are short and long-term trade-offs that are going to affect project dynamics. All of these work can work, but they involve these short-term versus long-term trade-offs, and models can be useful in evaluating the cost-benefit and in showing that things are worse in the short-term than they are, and they're going to improve in the long-term. And finally, let me just wrap up by saying another important question is, do teams gain effectiveness the same as individuals or groups of individuals? There's a difference between teams and groups of individuals. I think teams need to work together. And so there's been a lot of research on what drives team dynamics. Brian mentioned it, and so I guess I don't need to talk about this again. He mentioned the Henderson paper, and this long list actually came from one of Brian's course. There are endogenous things that affect team performance, like development of transactive memory systems and so forth, whether or not they specialize or not, and whether or not they run the risk of over-specializing. And people are building models that include these and other exogenous impacts on team performance, such as turnover, reward systems, and so on. If you're interested in that, this came from Brian's course, EM 425, I think, Brian. And so let me summarize by saying learning dynamics can have significant effect on project performance and schedule, should be included in models, maybe they need to be dimensioned, represented along many dimensions, and they can be accelerated, but often at short-term cost. And if you're interested in this, Brian's course, or if you're interested in system dynamics models of this, see me.
Thanks, Jim. And we'll continue this on Wednesday. Enjoy the eclipse. By the way, Friday, a reminder, Friday, we have a guest, an executive from Microsoft, who's coming in. So look for that email, and see you on Wednesday. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you so much, everybody.